Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. First romances are intense. They can feel like they might last forever, but mostly they don't. However, in this week's essay, Mary Claire Lawson writes about a first love that broke all the rules. It's read by Amanda Seyfried. She starred in Mamma Mia and Mean Girls. Her new movie is The Art of Racing in the Rain, in theaters August 9th.
One Monday night in May, 3 years ago, I was waiting outside Enid's, the best macaroni and cheese joint in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, for yet another mystery date to arrive. Lately, I had been binging on bad blind dates. Since moving to New York for college 14 years earlier, I had looked for love in the cracks and crevices of every wrinkle of the five boroughs, from Friendster to Nerve.com to Craigslist's misconnections. I had tried everything short of leaving the area. Oh, wait, I also flew to meet a stranger in Georgia for the weekend. Now I was at love's rock bottom. I had spent my 20s racked by adolescent anxiety and felt paralyzed by the length of my singlehood. It took me years to learn that dating drunk was not the way to connect with a soulmate or myself. I had always had to be merry times 10. 10 beers, 10 shots, 10 bars in one night. Merry alone just wasn't enough. When I got sober at 27, my social skills with men reverted to how I'd been at 16. When I was too self-conscious to talk to anyone I liked, other than the shy pianist who took me to the junior prom. When students lined up for the National Honor Society induction ceremony, I noticed this mysterious accompanist hunched over the piano like Schroeder from Peanuts. Curly hair in his face, an oversized sweater hanging off his skinny frame as his arms ran up and down the keys. As the principal babbled on stage, I recognized the song he was playing. It wasn't classical, it was by The Cure. He was my first love, though you would never have known it. I used to sit in our high school auditorium and watch him play the piano at the base of the stage. For school musicals, he would man the lights, and I would usually play the role of some two-bit whore. There I would be, prancing around the stage in a leotard, fishnet stockings, and high heels, singing about the wages of sin, while in real life I had never even been kissed. On my back all day, earning Satan's pay, I would belt out as he toiled in the booth, dimming the lights because there were nuns in the audience. I thought if I stared hard enough into that booth as I sang, he somehow would know I was singing to him. I started lobbying hard for him to ask me to the junior prom. And by lobbying, I mean telling everyone. Cast and crew, directors, teachers, the band pit, the 60-year-old wardrobe stylist that I wanted him to take me. When I knew the wheels were greased, I made my move. I offered him a ride home from rehearsal. We sat quietly in my parents' 89 LeBaron convertible as exhaust fumes leaked in through the dash. It may have been nerves or inhaling the exhaust, but I felt the world around us fade to white. "So, are you going to the prom?" I asked coyly. "Are you going?" he asked back. "I hope so. Has anyone asked you yet?" "Nope." "Well, do you want to go with me?" And so, I had my first date. My mother and I took the train into New York from Connecticut to find a dress, something we had never done before. In a Soho boutique, I found a metallic number with Asian detailing that made me feel like a superhero. I popped on a black velvet beret and a hot pink feather boa, and my dream look was complete. May came sooner than I expected, and suddenly there I was, back in the dress. I actually looked pretty. It may have been the first time I really believed that. Soon there was a knock at the door, and in walked my musical genius in a plaid jacket, Converse sneakers, carrying a sunflower. It was the cutest thing I'd ever seen. But I couldn't talk to him. There were so many words swimming in my head, but none came out of my mouth. I was afraid if I said the wrong thing, I might spoil the illusion. We posed for pictures on my lawn, standing 6 feet apart and looking in different directions. Finally, we got into the LeBaron and I drove us to the banquet hall. Once we arrived, I was too freaked out to do anything with him. So I busied myself with prom duties, affixing labels to the disposable cameras, going out to buy the prom song on cassette from Strawberry's music store, taking pictures with any and every person there. Hours passed. I couldn't even look in his direction, though at times I caught glimpses of him sitting alone at a table scribbling on a napkin drinking coffee. Finally, I managed to go over to him and try to make up for abandoning him the whole night. "Do you want to dance?" I asked. "No, thanks." "Please, just one dance." "No." And that was it. I had blown the whole thing. I tried to find the words to say how much I liked him and how sorry I was, to no avail. I drove us home in silence. There was no after party, no looking at the stars, and definitely no goodnight kiss. I didn't see him that summer, and by senior year, we had stopped saying hi to each other in the hallways. I missed him and the dream I had of us being together. Because I was certain he hated me, I retreated into my own head. Instead of talking to him about the prom, about anything, I ignored him. He didn't show up to graduation and seemed to vanish from the face of the earth. I tried to find him over the years, looking him up on Google, searching for where he lived, what he was doing. But he didn't seem to exist in my world or any other. Until that Monday night in Brooklyn, 14 years later, when he walked around the corner to join me for some macaroni and cheese at Enid's. A month earlier, a friend whom we had sat with at the prom posted a photo of that fateful evening on Facebook, tagging me. When I clicked on the notification, there we were. And then I saw that his sister had commented, "My brother would kill you for posting this." Here was my chance. I messaged her and asked, "How is your brother anyway?" Turned out he had just returned from a European tour with one of his bands and was living in Brooklyn. I looked up the band on MySpace and sent them a message, a short note about how the keyboardist and I had gone to the prom together in high school, and by any chance, did he remember me? He emailed the next day. He lived a few blocks away in Greenpoint. We both loved the same diner, rode the same train, sat in the same park to people watch. We made a date for Monday night. To sit across from a stranger I already knew felt both familiar and unbearable. I wanted to flash forward to the part when we already knew everything about each other, but in fact, we knew nothing about the adult versions of ourselves. This time, though, we had a hard time shutting up. In the last 14 years, he had graduated from music school and was playing all over the world. After living in Boston for a decade, he had moved to Greenpoint and was touring with a few bands that had shows in all the clubs I went to. We shared foggy memories of high school and vivid memories of our dating 20s. But unlike my blind dates of the last decade, I didn't have to be anyone other than myself with him. He knew all my secrets that first night. some from when I was 16, and some from 14 years later. As the waiters closed the restaurant, stacking chairs and rolling the front gate halfway down, my prom date and I decided it might be time to wrap up our reunion. We hadn't been in school for a long time, but with him, it still felt like a school night. "This was really fun," he said. "We should totally hang out again." I was thinking the same thing. And just like that, our days of awkward first dates were over. I had spent my whole time in New York bouncing from one rejection to the next, believing I was unlovable. Which made no sense to my prom date because he told me there was someone loving me all those years. Him. Within 6 months, we had moved in together. At our wedding last August, nearly 2 years later, my 7-year-old niece showed up in a metallic dress with Asian detailing, and my nephew surprised us by wearing tuxedo t-shirts and plaid shorts. I carried my own sunflower. It was the cutest thing I'd ever seen.
That's Amanda Seyfried reading Mary Claire Lawson's essay, "He's Playing Our Song." We'll catch up with Mary Claire after the break. Mary Claire Lawson and Chris have been together for about 10 years now. They live in Queens. Chris is a music teacher, and Mary Claire works in marketing. She told us more about what it was like to reconnect with him more than a decade after they graduated high school.
Chris was really my first relationship, my first serious relationship I ever had been in. So it was so new, and it was so fun, and we were watching movies and going on extremely long walks and ordering dinner and laughing, and he was playing in shows and I was going and watching, and you know, it was just so fun. When Chris had told me, like, he was out there just thinking about me all these years and loving me and all this, like, romantic and meaningful and amazing things, it was overwhelming. It was at that time that I was like, wow, I really need to start feeling and concentrating on all this positivity that's coming towards me instead of all the things I don't have.
Focusing on the positive was more difficult in the years after college. That's when Mary Claire realized she had a problem with alcohol. She says that getting sober a few years before reuniting with Chris was a major reason their relationship was possible.
Life before sobriety, and dating before sobriety especially, was a lot about, like, trying to fill this hole, trying to find a guy or a date or something that would make me feel fulfilled and loved and complete and happy. And I just kept searching for it in the bottom of a bottle. And after I got sober, I realized that, like, there's nothing really that can fill that hole. It's just you have to make room for it. I dated sober too and kept trying to go through those same motions of, like, putting up the mask and checking out and not really engaging with the people I was dating, and it didn't work. And so when I met Chris, I didn't have to, like, pretend I was someone I wasn't. I didn't have to try to put up this barrier with him. It was like he knew the real me already, and I knew he liked that person and I liked that person.
But Mary Claire says this story is about more than reconnecting with her prom date and getting married.
I didn't think I was ever going to find not just love, but happiness or fulfillment. another part that I'd like people to get from it is that, like, the choices you make in your life can change the outcome so many years down the road. If you're lucky, it's a long life, and you don't know what is in store for you. There's a lot of hope.
That's Mary Claire Lawson. She lives and works in New York. More after the break. Here's Amanda Seyfried.
The reason I chose this piece in particular was the line at the end when he said someone had been loving her the whole time. I just feel like there's so much we could do differently if we only believed that we were loved. I just feel like there's this epidemic for people, especially in their adolescence, to feel like they're not good enough. I mean, I'm 33, and I still feel like I'm a burden sometimes. And I just think it's really important for us, especially when we're in our teenage years, to know that we're loved unconditionally and we're supported by somebody. It's really beautiful and really positive, and it made me cry. So that was I sent it to my husband. I was like, this is the one. He's like, it's beautiful.
Thanks again to Amanda for reading this week's essay. She stars in The Art of Racing in the Rain in theaters August 9th. And here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
Something that's really true in what I see in what comes into the column is how comforting it is to reconnect with someone from long ago, especially high school years, in this world where we really date strangers. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that dating someone who was a complete stranger was really rare. It's hard to even think that dating apps didn't used to exist. And when they didn't, there was sort of the occasional blind date that was still set up through friends normally. But to date total strangers that come with no connection to you and you don't know their background, and like, that's what people do. And for a lot of them, it's scary. And that leads to this phenomenon of us going back to people from when we were growing up, and that sense of trust and of being known. And I just loved how that plays out in this story, and sort of gasped at the line when that someone had been loving her all this time, him.
Next week, Marcia Cross.
The call came in May. "Hello," the woman said. "My name is Anne Hurd. I work with the New Hampshire courts. I want you to sit down. Your son is looking for you." I had been hoping for this call for 21 years, and it came like a dream into an ordinary spring day.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Our intern is Shemi Aloko. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music courtesy of APM. And if you love the podcast, rate or review us at Apple Podcasts or tell a friend to listen. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.